even if you've got health insurance and it keeps what you pay for drugs relatively low, you've probably glanced at receipts and insurance statements that show the true price of the medicines you take. Ouch. Well, that's the personal experience. Then you probably remember when Turing Pharmaceuticals, under the leadership of Martin Shkreli, raised the price of one of its drugs from $13.50 a pill to $75. That seemed arbitrary. But the fact is, drugs do cost a lot, and plenty of people work to bring them down, or at least help us understand why they cost so much. California just passed a bill on drug price transparency, and Oregon groups are considering similar moves. Three guests join us to talk about the issue. Dr. Mariana Sokal is an assistant scientist at the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health at, of course, Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Sokal, thanks for joining us. Dr. Mariana Sokal, you there?
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
Sure, good to have you here. We also have Dr. Vinay Prasad at the Oregon Health Sciences University. Thank you for joining us. He's an oncologist and works in a number of areas about health policy. Good to talk to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Jesse O'Brien joins us with Oregonians for Affordable Drug Prices Now. Good to have you here as well, Jesse.
Great to be here. Excited to talk about the subject.
Dr. Sokal, let's start with you. One of the authors of a recent study, you are one of the authors of a recent study on policy options with high drug prices. Can you give us the general lay of the land and why drugs seem to cost so much?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, perfect. So good morning. It's a pleasure to be on your show. Actually, the landscape is it's a combination of, we have to remember, it's a combination of drug prices coming from branded drugs, which this particular research is about, and also generic drugs and specialty drugs. So high drug prices have been an issue across these three markets. And in the sense of the branded drugs, we see that it's very important to reward branded drugs with innovation that represent a true innovation and really improve the health of Americans. And so that's why prices and patents exist, to protect these drugs and to stimulate innovation. But what we've been seeing in these trends is that these prices for new drugs have been growing in excess of the general cost of the medical system, and also in excess of the trends in inflation and other consumer goods, for example. So not only that in itself is an issue, but also it's an issue that these rising costs actually limit access for people who need these drugs. So that's our main concern in terms of rising drug costs in this country, is that not only there is more resources going into drugs that could be going into other medical services, but also oftentimes preventing people from being able to use these important drugs.
Well, that was the question then. Do the high costs drive some patients out? They just don't get the treatment that those medicines would provide?
Yes, absolutely. But unfortunately, these access problems and access limitations, they don't only occur with branded drugs. They occur across the spectrum with also specialty drugs and generic drugs in some cases as well. So it's a more widespread problem than only branded drugs, unfortunately.
All right. So to come back to the original point about the branded drugs, is that you're saying that the money needs to be there for companies that put a lot of work into developing new products, but that the costs seem to be outstripping general rises of costs in the medical business and inflation generally?
Yes. And also what we see is that these rising costs are really greatly limiting people's access. For example, when we see the example of hepatitis C, which is a drug that, which is a condition that really is lethal if not treated. In hepatitis C case, for example, there is estimates that less than 10% of people who do have the condition ultimately get the treatment that they need in this country. So it's a major concern when you have a disease that is curable, that the drugs today can cure this condition, but because of costs, less than 10% of people get the cure that they could save their life.
Less than 10%?
Yes, about 10%, yeah. It can be. It depends a little bit on the population groups. If we look at, for example, people who depend on Medicaid or people who are uninsured, of course, this is for uninsured people, of course, this is a bigger problem. But we see this also on people with health insurance, because oftentimes patients have to participate in the payment for these drugs. So patients, for these very high-cost drugs, patients often cannot afford the co-payments. And that really limits adherence to the treatments and access in general. So we see these compromises to health coming from these high cost drugs.
Dr. Vinay Prasad, I noticed you got your Master of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. Do you know Dr. Sokal?
I don't know Dr. Sokal. I do not.
No, okay. Well, here we go, getting a head start. you are getting a reputation, Dr. Prasad, for being a sharp critic of some of the current medical practices, including drug prices and much more in medicine. Give us an idea of the thrust of your work, how you see it.
I would agree with much of what's been said. I think, it's clear that, no one is saying that drug companies should take a loss. I mean, everyone believes there should be some profitability in the system to encourage people to go out and try to make new drugs. The reality is that the profit margin reaped in this sector is a tremendous profit margin that rivals, any other industry and even the most profitable industries. And there's a lot to be said about the overall risk benefit of being in this industry, of the pharmaceutical industry. And it looks like a very favorable place to be based on the profit year after year after year. In terms of drug pricing, I think that the impact is crippling. It's crippling in two ways. One, on patients, there's a number of studies that show that as out-of-pocket expenses go up, people are less likely to take medicines, even if those medicines are what they really need and will make them better off. The other way it's crippling is in terms of society. We all have to pay for the high price of these pharmaceutical drugs, and that inherently comes at the cost of other things we can be investing in as a society. And, we're at a situation now where healthcare spending is approaching 20% of GDP. I mean, how high can it go? There has to be a tipping point before a society can say we can't spend more than some amount of money on healthcare because we have other things to invest in as well. In my field, cancer medicine, drug prices are really out of control. They're routinely over $100,000 per year of treatment. We just had a new drug that was approved that is a record $475,000 for a single dose. I think reasonable people would agree that these prices are too high. And it would be one thing if the drugs were curative. Every time I listen to something, people talk about Hep C drugs, but they're just picking on the one exceptional case. The reality is in cancer medicine, the majority of our new drugs are really marginal. They leave more to be desired. Just to give you a piece of data, of 71 drugs that were approved consecutively for solid cancers, the average improvement in survival was 2.1 months. As a doctor who sees patients, I think every day is important, but 2.1 months is just not good enough for my patients. My patients deserve better. So we're paying these prices for benefits that are often trivial and fleeting, and we have to ask ourselves if that's worth it. It seems ridiculous.
We're talking about drug prices generally and in our region more specifically. Dr. Vinay Prasad's at OHSU in Portland. Dr. Mariana Sokal's at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Jesse O'Brien is with us from Oregonians for Affordable Drug Prices Now. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Tell us about what you're paying for drugs or whether there are drugs you don't buy because they cost too much. jx@jeffnet.org is the way to reach us through email. Jesse O'Brien, what are we doing in Oregon? What are you doing in Oregon to bring drug prices down?
Well, so first and foremost, we're working to build a movement to do something about the problem, which I think almost everybody who doesn't work for a pharmaceutical corporation agrees is a serious problem. So Oregonians for Affordable Drug Prices Now is a big coalition, and we're looking to add individuals and groups that are interested in doing something about the rising cost of drugs. I personally am from OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, which is a statewide consumer group, but our coalition also includes businesses and workers and nurses and teachers and doctors and pharmacists and a number of different parts of the healthcare industry, including health insurance companies and hospitals, with whom we don't necessarily agree very much about a lot of other things, but we all agree that the rising cost of prescription drugs is a big problem. So we encourage your listeners to check out our website, which is affordablerxnow.org, where you can find some more out about the campaign. But the one thing I would add to what the much smarter than me people who spoke before me said is that you know, I think this is a problem that really affects all of us, not just patients who rely on these extra expensive drugs to maintain their health or to save their lives, although it's a special burden on them because they have to shoulder sometimes really obscene out-of-pocket costs at the pharmacy. But it's really a burden on all of us because a lot of the cost winds up getting picked up by insurance companies and passed along in the form of higher premiums, or gets picked up by large employers who have to pass it on to really all of us in the form of higher prices, and it can be a real drag on the economy. And finally, it's a big burden on taxpayers and state and local government budgets. So really, we're all paying the price. And what we're looking to do here in Oregon is, just as a first step to kind of get our arms around the problem, to create some real transparency for the pharmaceutical industry so that we have some idea of where all of this money is going. So what we're looking to do is to replicate what our neighbors to the south in California just recently did with their new legislation, which is called Senate Bill 17, which basically it does a lot of things. I can get into the details, but the brief version is that it requires prescription drug companies to explain why their prices are going up and to give 60-day notice in advance of a price increase. And you know, that by itself is not going to solve the problem, but at the very least, it'll give us a sense of where the money's going, and it'll help the state and health insurance companies, the health insurance industry, and consumers all plan around these giant prices more effectively.
So Dr. Mariana Sokol at Johns Hopkins, given the size and political strength of California, having that state pass this bill, do you see other states following suit?
Yes, we see actually it even prior. Maryland had an attempt of passing a similar law. Vermont had a similar law in 2016. But it's very, very important that California pass this law, because there is actually an innovation there that is not only they're collecting this information from manufacturers, which is really important because they are the first ones who set the list price for the drugs, but the California bill is also incorporating a requirement that the plans, the drug plans, the insurance plans, also provide information on how much the premiums are changing. Just like Jesse said, we're all footing the bill together, you know, even people who do not take medication. So it's really important that this new law has incorporated also this requirements for us to understand and be able to, over time, get a sense of how the system is dealing with this high-cost prices, you know, with these high prices in terms of how much does this change the premiums and so on.
Dr. Vinay Prasada, I circled that figure you gave a little bit ago, $475,000 for a single dose. I mean, it raises the question, who drug companies are producing drugs for?
Well, drug companies have benefited from legislation that, at least in the space of cancer medicine, Medicare, which is one of the largest payers, they're legally obligated to pay for every drug that is FDA approved. Worse than that, there's an expert guidelines body. There's a few of them. And Medicare is legally required to pay for any drug that is recommended by one of these guidelines bodies for an off-label use with a high recommendation. So Medicare is legally required to pay for certain uses, even if those uses are have lower levels of evidence or maybe even small benefits or maybe even uncertain benefits. And to top it all off, they're not allowed to negotiate the price. So the real question is, why only $475,000 a dose? If you're forced to buy my product and you can't negotiate the price with me, I could charge you $2 million a dose and $3 million a dose. And I guess if current trends continue, there is no reason why it won't reach that point. The only reason that keeps a drug maker from charging that much a dose is simply the fear that they will be on the radio and on television and be criticized. That's the only downward pressure in the market. This is a ridiculous situation. It's not a free market. I hate to say the term rigged system, but it feels like it's a rigged system, rigged in the benefit of the companies that are making these products.
So, Dr. Sokol, Medicare Part D, the drug benefit, passed almost 15 years ago and obviously did not include the ability of the federal government to negotiate with drug companies. How strong are the drug companies politically?
Yeah, that's very important. But at the same time, we see that within Medicare Part D, there is negotiation via the prescription drug plans. So we see that although Medicare covers so many individuals, these smaller plans that actually serve contingents of these enrollees, they have to individually negotiate with companies. So there's a lot of power of negotiation that is lost, because instead of having one single negotiation for all beneficiaries from Part D, we see this happening in smaller groups. And what happens is that these prescription drug plans that people can choose every year, they can enroll, these drug plans, they actually end up oftentimes setting up utilization controls in order to access these drugs. So anybody, any Medicare Part D beneficiary who's listening to us and has ever needed a higher cost drug within Part D, they probably have had to fill either a prior authorization, or they have to face a quantity limit for these drugs, or even much higher copays once, you know, the drug is very expensive. So even though Medicare is required to pay, oftentimes patients get still excluded from taking the drug because of these utilization controls. And the interesting thing is that manufacturers know that many people will not be able to access that innovation. And I agree also with Dr. Prasad that not all innovation really changes health. There's, you know, a big discussion about how much really this several innovative drugs really produce a value that is appropriate to the price that they're charging, let's say. But even then, we see that oftentimes manufacturers acknowledge, they know that not everybody will be able to access their drugs, and yet they are producing the drugs with these, they're setting the high prices at launch for these drugs, even acknowledging that.
We're talking about drug prices in America with Dr. Mariana Sokal from Johns Hopkins University, where she's at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, Dr. Vinay Prasad from OHSU. Jesse O'Brien is with Oregonians for Affordable Drug Prices Now. Join us on the exchange in the few minutes we have left, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jesse, given the political and economic forces at work here and Oregon's relatively small size and population, I mean, how much influence can people in this state have in the overall picture, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think ideally this is something where we would see a federal solution, but I think we're not in a position where we can wait for that here in Oregon. It's really past the point of being a crisis and is now just frankly absurd. And I think that the first thing we can do, which Oregon is in as good a position to do as any other state, is just create some real transparency around where the money is going here. You know, in Oregon, you know, I would strongly agree with Dr. Prasad that this is basically a broken market for drugs, and there's no effective counterbalance to the pricing power of the industry. And you know, one thing that we have a good track record of doing here in Oregon is addressing exactly that kind of situation through transparency and accountability for the industry. We've done that with health insurance companies for many years now, where health insurers have to justify their rate increases every year. And my organization, OSPIRG, has been involved in that process for many years as a voice for consumers. And we've seen that has been
Whoops, there went Jesse O'Brien for some reason. Not sure what happened there.
Certainly not as low as we'd like.
There you are.
But you know, we think that could be a model for addressing the cost of prescription drugs going forward. But at the very least, we need some transparency, and we're calling on Oregon policymakers to put in place a transparency framework during the next legislative session that starts next February.
Dr. Prasad, we've talked about the political strength now. How strong are the drug companies themselves and the marketing level? I mean, how well do they influence the choices that doctors make from your research?
So I've done a fair bit of research to look into this, and I guess I would say that it is concerning. I think the reality is, I'll just give you one anecdote. You know, when I talk to my doctor colleagues who are not oncologists, and I tell them about some new cancer drug actually we don't know if it improves survival at all. All we know is it kind of changes the way tumors look on imaging scans, which, to be honest, is the reality for maybe up to a third of cancer drugs that are approved. That's all we know, is it changes how tumors look on scans. We don't know if people live longer or feel better. And then I tell my colleagues that, and it only changes these scans for a couple months longer than if we didn't give the drug at all. Well, they look at me like I'm crazy and say, you know, that just doesn't sound that great. That sounds like it's not good enough for our patients. But when you have the same conversation with some of the most lauded experts in oncology, the ones who set the guidelines and set the approvals through the use of these guidelines bodies, you find a different discussion. You find people really sort of staunchly defending these drugs and defending these kind of imaging tests that really may not fully capture what patients feel. And one wonders why this disconnect is so great. And some of the research we've done has really kind of suggested that the role of financial conflict of interest may be one of the reasons. Doctors who write those guidelines, oncologists, study recently showed that 85% of them have a personal payment from a drug or device maker in the United States. I think it is hard.
Which is legal. It is legal, correct?
Oh, it is legal. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who defend it and say there's some positive consequences. Don't you want doctors and pharmaceutical companies to work together to make products accessible to patients? And I think that's true. And, you know, I always say I work together with the medical students often. We do a lot of papers together, but not one of them has ever paid me $100,000, although I'm still waiting for that student. No, but you know, so you can work with the industry, but the receipt of personal payments, I think, is a proven biasing factor. It's proven in much sociology and psychology literature, and yet it's a practice that continues largely today. And one wonders if it is part of the root reason why marginal benefits are not more widely criticized by expert physicians and instead often tacitly accepted.
Dr. Sokol, we have about a half a minute left. There is an FDA, a Food and Drug Administration. How much power does it have to regulate prices or features on drugs?
So FDA, actually, it's not under their scope to regulate prices. And they what they do is approving drugs that have demonstrated some effectiveness and safety. And like Dr. Prasad was saying, you know, what effectiveness is can be questioned sometimes. But once the drugs are approved, they are under patents. And these patents are something that protects the price. Now, a question that has been coming up oftentimes is that sometimes even if the active ingredient of a drug has expired a patent, pharmaceutical companies have been exploiting ways to patent either an injector for the drug or a means to use
the
drug.
Okay, Dr. Sokol, I'm sorry we have to go. Dr. Mariana Sokol, Dr. Vinay Prasad, Jesse O'Brien, thank you all for joining us on The Exchange.